John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Kathleen Dunn Show today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, here we are again with another terrorist bombing in another European city, and all of the usual news stories coming out from that, stories about the victims, stories about the investigation, some of which sound like police procedural dramas on television. All the usual pundits saying all the usual things, fairly predictable responses from people running for president and all of that. So lots of coverage on that aspect of this terrible tragedy in Brussels. What we're going to talk about today, though, we'll take a little bit different tack. My guest is Andrew Bacevich, a retired U.S. Army colonel who lost a son in the Iraq War. He's now Professor Emeritus of International Relations and History at Boston University, and he has a new book out that describes 40 years of American military policy in the Middle East. And I think by the end of the program, we should have succeeded in maybe making a connection between what's happened over the last four decades in the Middle East and what we have seen recently in the world in terms of terrorism and what's been going on in the Middle East and why these problems seem so intractable. We, of course, as always, welcome your participation in this program. Here's how you can get in touch. It's a different number today. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. You can also find the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook and leave your comment or question there. Andrew Bacevich, welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show. Thanks for joining me today.
Well, thanks very much for having me on the program.
Your book is titled America's War for the Greater Middle East. You describe in it the 40-year history of American involvement militarily in the Middle East, and we're going to talk about that during the course of this hour. But as I said, it seems like we have these same conversations over and over again. Nothing seems to change, not in the Middle East, not in the rest of the world. Are we just going to have to accept the fact that we're in a state of perpetual war with no real end in sight?
Well, I hope we don't. I take your larger point that each time we suffer one of these episodes, whether it's in Europe or elsewhere in the world, the conversation that's stimulated tends to be repetitious. And I think more troubling that the conversation tends to focus on that immediate specific event rather than trying to understand that event in some broader historical context. It's as if each terrorist incident stands alone, stands apart, and I think that type of thinking tends not to be particularly useful.
Well, and not only, I mean, you have, there's a lack of context, which is, it's kind of ironic considering the number of news agencies that we have and the amount of information that gets published on the internet, let alone on the cable TV networks. Everything seems to be focused on who can get the latest piece of information out the fastest rather than stepping back and taking a look and saying, wait a minute, what connects all of these things?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, I'm not in the news business, but as a consumer of news, there does seem to be a powerful tendency to emphasize the here and now, and quite frankly, to treat history as a somewhat boring afterthought. I'm a historian by training, so my bias is to say we ought to flip that and to pay much more attention to history itself, and to try to fit events into that larger context as a way to come to greater understanding of what happened within the last news cycle. But that's not the way the news business works.
Well, we don't get too many historians on as pundits on the cable news channels, that's for sure. And my bias is toward history. My undergraduate degree was in that as well. The Islamic State has claimed responsibility for this most recent bombing. But ultimately, and again, we always want to assess responsibility and put blame or fix some individual cause to this. But this is much, much bigger than the Islamic State, isn't it?
Well, I think so. I mean, certainly the Islamic State is a vile entity. It's vicious. It's bloodthirsty. But it certainly did not come out of nowhere. And indeed, sadly, the United States has played an unfortunate role in creating the conditions that allows an organization like ISIS to exist and to enjoy the success that it has. I'm referring here, of course, chiefly to the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. The George W. Bush administration undertook that war with the expectation that an easy victory in Iraq was going to pave the way to a broader transformation of the region that would lead Iraq and its neighbors to becoming democratic, stable, pro-Western. What the George W. Bush administration got instead of a short war ending in victory was an exceedingly long, costly, ambiguous war that ended in anything but success, and indeed ended with Iraq thoroughly destabilized and as such vulnerable to terrorist organizations such as first Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Remember, Al-Qaeda didn't exist in Iraq prior to 2003. And then subsequent to Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which was largely taken down, the rise of ISIS. That's the history, at least that's an aspect of the history, that demands far greater attention than it gets in the news.
Well, and I mean, one of the again, I don't expect you to make comments as a media expert, but the appetite for news consumers for introspection and context is not that great. I mean, the stories that would describe context would be a lot more work for the average news consumer than the kind of immediate reaction sort of things, comments that we got from presidential candidates in the aftermath of the bombing and things like that. Those kinds of sound bites are what people seem to be consuming rather than context. So how do we have an intelligent discussion about this where we can actually have an opportunity to say, hey, wait a minute, we need to put this in perspective?
Well, that's a great question, and I'm quite sure that I don't have a satisfactory answer. In particular, in the political moment that we're in right now, with perhaps the exception of Senator Sanders, I see little evidence among the other candidates to engage in any serious introspection, any stock-taking of how previous U.S. actions may have contributed to the rampant dysfunction that exists in the greater Middle East and that then manifests itself from time to time in things like the terrorist attack in Belgium. Why the absence of introspection? Well, I think to some degree it's because both parties are responsible. It's not as if the flaws in U.S. policy in the greater Middle East can be laid simply at the foot of one party as opposed to the other. The book that you referred to that I wrote that's just coming out basically tells a story of U.S. military actions in the region dating from 1980 when Jimmy Carter promulgated the Carter Doctrine and inadvertently, I think, began the process of militarizing U.S. policy in the Islamic world. The book marches forward from 1980 and tells the story of one misguided military effort after another undertaken by each administration in succession, and that is to say, undertaken by both Republican presidents and Democratic presidents. So neither party has much of an interest in actually coming to an understanding of what we tried to do and how our efforts have gone awry.
You mentioned 1980, and in your book you talk about the failed operation to try to rescue the hostages in Tehran. You talk about the fact that we didn't really what the lesson we learned was the wrong lesson, and I'm not quoting you exactly there, but that's the gist of your response to that. Explain what you mean there.
Well, the failed Iran hostage rescue attempt of April 1980 really was the first campaign, if we want to use that term, of our war for the greater Middle East. It was a small-scale and abbreviated campaign that really the operation never even made it to the objective area before it unfolded, or it collapsed, rather, as a result of some bad luck and some poor planning. The U.S. military's response to that failure was basically to say, we're going to try harder. We're going to do better next time. And in a sense, as an institutional response on the part of the military, that's quite understandable and perhaps even admirable. But the political response to that failure is the one that's more troublesome, because the political response also then tended to be one that said, through the further deepening militarization of U.S. policy in the region, we can fix things. I want to emphasize the extent to which, although Carter got this ball rolling, Carter had really minimal understanding of the implications of the Carter Doctrine that he promulgated. But by the time his successor enters office, that's Ronald Reagan, of course, in 1981, it's Reagan who really begins to set in motion this pattern of interventionism, a failed peacekeeping mission in Lebanon, a misfired air campaign directed at Muammar Gaddafi of Libya, intervention in the Iran-Iraq War, I think we should call it the first Gulf War of 1980 to 1980, believe it or not, on behalf of Saddam Hussein. So these were the preliminary campaigns undertaken during Reagan's watch, useful for us to remember today because of the absence of any serious strategic logic for what the president was doing. And that absence of strategic logic ends up being a perpetual problem that continues down to the present moment when we're engaged in fighting against ISIS in Syria and Iraq. We're bombing Somalis. We're supporting Saudi Arabia and Yemen. Reports say the Obama administration is seriously considering yet another air campaign in Libya. Going where? For what purpose? It's entirely unclear.
The strategic logic that you talk about, describe. I mean, let's. I don't want to stay in the 1980s, although that was a pretty good decade for me. When you talk about the lack of strategic logic, where did that come from? Is this a product of a fundamental misunderstanding of the Middle East? Why weren't we able to make better choices?
Well, General Stanley McChrystal, subsequent to his being fired as the senior U.S. commander in Afghanistan, remarked in passing that, and at that point we'd been fighting in Afghanistan for over a decade, remarked as to the deficiency of American understanding of Afghan history, Afghan culture. That was a belated acknowledgement of an ignorance that I think applies to our entire military effort in the greater Middle East. When we began to gear up for military intervention back in the 1980s, the Defense Department, the Pentagon, saw the problem really as a technical problem. How do we figure out how to project U.S. forces 7,000 or 8,000 miles into the Persian Gulf? What are the requirements in terms of air bases, of seaports, of pre-positioned material? They did not see the problem in terms of a Western intervention into a region where previous Western interventions, primarily by European imperialists, had created havoc in place of order. So there was this abiding ignorance with regard to the context, and I think that's one of the explanations for why U.S. planners failed to come up with a strategy that made any sort of sense to guide U.S. policy.
We need to take a short break, and then when we come back, we'll have more with Andrew Bacevich and your calls and questions. What questions do you have about yesterday's attacks in Brussels related to what our guests could speak to here today? We're talking about America's involvement in the Middle East as being connected to these terrorist attacks. What role should America be playing in the region? What do you see as being important? And do you believe that conflict is, in this case, is inevitable? What do you think ought to be done? And maybe even how should our politicians be approaching this situation? Are you happy with the kind of reactions that we've been seeing so far from, for example, presidential candidates? That's all fodder for discussion this hour on the Kathleen Dunn Show. John Munsett in for Kathleen Dunn. You can reach us by a variety of methods. 800-642-1234 is the toll-free number. 800-642-1234. Talk@WPR.org is the email address, and The Kathleen Dunn Show is on Facebook. You can leave your comment or question there. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. My guest this hour is Andrew Bacevich, retired U.S. Army colonel who lost a son in the Iraq War. He's now professor emeritus of international relations and history at Boston University. He is the author of a number of books on foreign policy, and his latest, America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History, will be published next month. 800-642-1234, the number to call to join our discussion today. And we do welcome your participation in this because, well, it is a call-in talk show after all. So Andrew Bacevich, we've kind of set the table for all of this. The persistent theme seems to be a lack of understanding of what really of Middle Eastern culture and the history of the Middle East and how things actually work there, and it has involved the administrations of both Republicans and Democrats. We talked about the Reagan administration and how things were done during Reagan's time in the White House. Let's move ahead to just for a moment to President Clinton, because there we had all the events that happened in the Balkans and a variety of other things. How is it that this lack of strategic logic persisted from one administration to the next, regardless of party?
Well, I think one factor here, and we'll talk specifically about Clinton, is the relative inexperience and, frankly, naivete of the individuals that we elect to be commander-in-chief. The last president that we elected who came into office with serious foreign policy credentials was George Herbert Walker Bush, who served for one term. Since then, we've had Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Barack Obama. In essence, each one has used the presidency as a vehicle for on-the-job training, learning about statecraft. So Clinton in particular, certainly a gifted politician, and very adept at picking up notions and ideas, learned enough about foreign policy to make a show of expertise when he was challenging George Herbert Walker Bush. But once he became president, it became pretty clear, in particular with regard to actions in the Islamic world, that he didn't have any serious understanding of the situation. He inherited from Bush the Somalia intervention and presided over what ended up being the debacle of the Mogadishu firefight in October of 1993, followed by a humiliating U.S. withdrawal. Somalia was a failure, one that we've largely forgotten, one that Osama bin Laden, among other people, found to be exceedingly instructive, however. Clinton continued the policy begun by George Herbert Walker Bush of trying to contain Iraq, something that involved maintaining the so-called no-fly zones and, in effect, sustaining low-level hostilities directed against Iraq for the entire decade. Those hostilities didn't pacify Iraq, didn't eliminate Saddam Hussein. They may well have contributed to the death of large numbers of Iraqi children because they were part of a severe program of sanctions. So Clinton, an exceedingly bright man, also never really conceived of a strategy.
We have callers who want to join us, and I want to involve as many people in this discussion this hour as we can. Let's start in Milwaukee, where Josh is with us. Josh, hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'd love to hear the guest's opinion on the idea that this is a probable outcome and one that we were actually hoping for. There are people in this country, and they have lots of money and power, and they are vested in continuing, hostilities all over the planet. And so while on the general national level, we act surprised that these things take place and that they can't stop and nobody knows how to get out from underneath this. But in reality, there's a lot of people who really want this to keep happening. And how do we get money and power to oppose those voices?
Josh, thanks for your question. Andrew Basevich?
Well, I probably differ with Josh at least a little bit. He's referring to what we might call the national security apparatus, those institutions, corporate entities that are invested in what they refer to as American global leadership, which implies the necessity of continued high levels of military spending and a global military presence. I don't think that they're invested necessarily in having a sequence of failed U.S. military enterprises, which is basically what we've been experiencing. But there is a military-industrial complex, as President Eisenhower told us several decades ago. It does wield influence. Josh's question is, what can we do about it? I think one thing we can do about it is to recognize that what Eisenhower warned us against still persists today, this nefarious influence. What we ought to do is, in terms of our political involvement, is to find a way to steer at least one of the parties away from the assumptions undergirding the prevailing definition of American global leadership. I mean, we have two pro-war parties. We need to have at least one party that may not be utterly anti-war or overtly anti-war, but at least a party that is somewhat skeptical of the perpetuation of the status quo. And we don't have those skeptics in either party today.
Josh, thanks for your call. Let's go to Paul, who is next. And Paul is calling us from Merrill. Welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show, Paul.
Thank you. My comment or question, combination of both, would push this discussion back behind 1980 to at least 1953, when, so I understand, the United States and Britain undermined the democratically elected president of Iran and put in the Shah, who then ruled as a dictator until the so-called Islamic Revolution of 1979. So Professor Bacevich talked about the failed rescue attempt under Carter to get the hostages away from the American embassy in Iran, but he never told us why there were hostages there or what had been the backdrop to the Iranian revolution taking those hostages. And I would like some comment on that, please.
Paul, thanks for your question. Andrew Bacevich?
It's an excellent point. The subtitle of my book is A Military History. The story I tell is of U.S. military involvement in the Islamic world. Prior to 1980, U.S. military involvement was minimal. Virtually the only notable, and it's barely notable, U.S. military intervention prior to 1980 in the region was Eisenhower's very brief insertion of a small number of troops into Lebanon, which ended without any American casualties whatsoever. So 1980 is a break point because that's when the militarization of U.S. policy begins. But as Paul correctly notes, that does not mean that the United States was not involved in the region earlier than 1980. And the event that he points to, U.S. Involvement, CIA and MI6, British MI6 involvement in a coup in Iran that put the Shah back on the throne, is an event of enormous significance that really then is one of the complaints of the Iranian revolutionaries in 1979 who overthrow the Shah and immediately identify the United States as their adversary. So good point. Just want to emphasize the story I tell is not the story of U.S. policy in the greater Middle East. It's a story of U.S. military involvement in the greater Middle East.
Well, historically, and again, this is the topic for an entire other hour, but as over the last 10 years that I've been filling in as a talk show host, I've had a lot of conversations about with Middle East policy experts, and we always end up talking about the fall of the Ottoman Empire and the artificial boundary is created by the European powers. You referred to the influence of European imperialism in the Middle East as being kind of one of the backdrops for a lot of the problems that we're seeing today. So, you know, we could spend all afternoon going through a year-by-year history of what's happened over there. Paul, thanks so much for your call. 800-642-1234, the number to call to join our discussion. Andrew Bacevich is my guest, and a lot to chew on this hour. Let's go to Roger in Poinet next. Roger, hello. Welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
I'm referring to the militarization and the mistakes we made. I know it seems like we're bad-mouthing Democratic presidents, but how about George W. when we were in Iraq with Dick Cheney and Halliburton and the military complex there? But the issue I want to talk about is we neglected to use the Iraqi generals in their army to use them in any way after we took over Iraq. As a result, from my understanding, they developed their own army, and it became ISIS. You want to refer to that part? Thanks.
Roger, thanks for the call. Andrew Bacevich, you did take the George W. Bush administration to task earlier in the program. Roger may have missed that. But what about the connection between the discarded Iraqi military leaders and ISIS that Roger wants to make?
I think Roger is skipping over some of the steps that we need to take into account. When the U.S. invaded, when the George W. Bush administration invaded Iraq in 2003, it did so with an expectation that a political transformation in Iraq would happen pretty quickly and pretty easily. That was a major miscalculation. Contributing to the miscalculation was a ill-advised decision early on to disband whatever remained of Iraq's army. This is now post-fall of Baghdad. It seems pretty clear that one of the consequences of that decision decision was to create a pool of Iraqis who had no interest in assisting the Americans to produce order, and who became a pool from which proponents of insurgency could recruit fighters. Now, initially, this is not ISIS. Initially, this is the largely Sunni, not entirely, opposition to the insurgents. It became also Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and then in a further iteration became what we call ISIS today. So there is a logic trail that explains how ill-advised U.S. actions help to contribute to the emergence of the present-day enemy. It's just not quite so simple as saying we didn't make use of Iraqi generals.
800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, the number to call to join our program. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today on the Kathleen Dunn Show. She'll be back tomorrow. My guest, Andrew Bacevich, retired U.S. Army Colonel, Professor Emeritus of International Relations and History at Boston University, has a new book coming out on the military history of the last 40 years of American military efforts in the Middle East. And we're kind of using that to place in context what happened in Brussels. Again, that's the genesis of this program is those two bombs that went off this week. But we're trying to take a little bit different tack than all of the other coverage you're going to be seeing and hearing and reading about these attacks and try to place it into some sort of context today. And so that's been our focus. It's kind of squishy, and it's a little bit hard to get our arms around, but we're doing the best that we can. Let's take a call from Sharon in Managua next. Sharon, hello. Welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Program.
Hi. Thank you very much. This is another excellent program. My comment, actually, I have kind of one major comment and then just another comment. I like the fact that your guest speaker is talking about the history of the Middle East, because it does have, you know, we know so little about this part of the world, and yet we've had so much influence. And my main comment is about the one topic that seems to all we seem to skirt around quite a bit when we talk about the Middle East is the role of the United States in having Israel as a surrogate for our military. We provide so much funds to Israel, and we forget about the, you know, the displacement of the Palestinians in order to expand territory for Israel. That never seems to be talked about very much. And, you know, if we were to really look at history, though, too, so much of the problems in the Middle East really stretch back to World War One, practically, and to the time when oil was originally discovered in that part of the world. I'm driving right now, so I'll take my I'll be happy to hear the comments, but I'll take it off the air.
Sharon, thank you for those comments. Andrew Bacevich?
Well, I think it's not correct to describe Israel as a surrogate of the United States. The Israeli Defense Forces exist for a very specific purpose, and that is to ensure the security of the state of Israel. Rarely does the IDF act on behalf of the United States. As a matter of fact, in my book, I emphasize episodes such as the ill-fated Lebanon peacekeeping operation of 1982-1983, when U.S. Marines on the ground in Lebanon really viewed Israeli forces as among their adversaries, as part of the problem. But to the larger point that I think Sharon is making, and that is that to explain the factors contributing to the dysfunction that exists in the greater Middle East does push us far further and further back in history, and leads us to identify a variety of factors. Yes, the creation of Israel after World War II is part of the problem. That is to say, is one of the sources for instability and friction in the region. So too is oil. So too is the sectarian divisions within Islam. Unfortunate record of European imperialism, the deficit in enlightened leadership in the Arab world. All of these are contributing factors to the problem. One of the points of my book, however, is that given the complexity of the issues involved, how remarkably naive U.S. policymakers have been in imagining that somehow or other the adroit application of military power to this region is going to fix things. And yet, from one administration to the next, that illusion has persisted, even as the application of U.S. military power more often than not simply was making matters worse at great cost to the United States and an even greater cost to the people living in the region.
Let's take a quick break here. When we come back, Andrew Bacevich, I'd like to kind of shift our focus a little bit to in the aftermath of this latest tragedy in Brussels. Going forward, what's to be done? What can we? Is there a way out of this? At the beginning, I asked if we were in a state of perpetual war. I think your response was, "I hope not," and I'm paraphrasing. But let's. I'd like us to turn the discussion just a little bit to talk about maybe a way forward here, or some way that we correct what we've done in the past. And we have a lot more callers. We'll try and get to as many of those as we can here in the rest of the time we have left this hour. Andrew Bacevich is my guest, and he is a retired U.S. Army colonel who lost a son in the Iraq War. He is now professor emeritus of international relations and history at Boston University. And he's also the author of a number of books, including his most recent, America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History, which will be coming out next month. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to this program on the Ideas Network. This hour, in the aftermath of the terrorist attacks in Brussels this week, we're trying to take a step back and maybe put some context and get a broader view of what's going on here. Andrew Bacevich is my guest. He's a retired U.S. Army colonel, professor emeritus of international relations and history at Boston University, and the author of a book that'll come out next month, America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History. So the way forward here, is there such a thing as a viable strategy against ISIS? And if so, what would it look like, do you think?
Well, I think what we need, and I'm not trying to dodge your question, but the issue is not devising a viable strategy against ISIS. The issue is one of devising a viable strategy against the larger phenomenon of which ISIS is one manifestation, but not the sole manifestation. This problem of violent Islamic radicalism, some individuals and groups from within Islam that are intent on waging jihad against the West. We could destroy ISIS tomorrow, and that larger threat would still persist. But your question is, what can we do about it? I'd suggest three things to consider. And the first, most immediate thing is to self-protect. I don't pretend to be an expert on Belgium, but listening to people who do claim to know something about Belgium, it appears that the interior security agencies of Belgium are notoriously inept. That is to say, they let their guard down. When you let your guard down, you render yourself vulnerable to attack, and that appears to be what happened. So the lesson for Belgium is the same lesson that we learned in the aftermath of 9/11, and that is you need to properly resource your domestic security agencies. You need to ensure that they have effective leadership. That does not guarantee that there will be no attacks. It does minimize the likelihood of those attacks doing. So the Belgium failure, in that sense, is a reminder that we need to make sure that, that we have our house in order. The second thing, I think, the second point is that given the failure of U.S. military interventionism in the region to bring order, and indeed our contributions to aggravating the disorder, we need to give up on the notion that Western military power can fix things. And I think we need to encourage parties within the region that have a common interest in restoring stability. We need to encourage them to take on that responsibility. That means that countries like Saudi Arabia and Iran and Iraq and Turkey are going to need to learn to collaborate with one another because they all share this transcendent interest in order, even if they differ from one another on other very important issues. And then the third thing, I think, the really long-term thing, is recognizing that the root of the problem is the challenge faced by some within the Islamic world of reconciling faith with modernity, is to try to do what we can working on the margins to encourage that that reconciliation. How do we do that? Well, by living up to our own professed ideals, and frankly, by encouraging the sort of cultural and educational exchanges that can begin to persuade particularly young people from the Islamic world that we are not the enemy. Now, that strategy that I just laid out is one that would take years to unfold, and therefore, the last point, I think, would be that forget about quick fixes. This is going to be a long, complicated problem to deal with.
Let's take some more phone calls here in the last few minutes of the show. We have Sarah on the line with us from Lake Zurich, Illinois. Sarah, good afternoon. Welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Well, thank you, John. And maybe I missed this during your show, but I would like the guest, I'm really curious for a more explicit link between our foreign policy intervention and other European intervention, how that led not only to being able to recruit people to jihadist causes, but how did it lead to the rise of, say, the Taliban and other, and, you know, fundamentalist Islam that we see, like, in Pakistan, where, you know, you can't speak out without getting killed.
Andrew Basevich, is there a link between U.S. policy and the rise of Islamic fundamentalism?
Yes, there is. And let's talk specifically about the Taliban, since that's what Sarah was pointing to. And let me emphasize, the point here is not to argue that the United States is somehow exclusively responsible for the problems that are prevalent in some parts of the Islamic world. The point is to say that, more often than not, our military efforts have proven to be counterproductive. And I think the Taliban offer a classic example. Back in 1979, during the Carter presidency, President Carter initiated a program of providing covert support to Afghans who were opposed to Soviet influence in their country. This is a program that then Ronald Reagan adopted and greatly expanded, in particular after the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. So we funded Islamic militants during the 1980s because we believed that those Islamic militants could embarrass, weaken the Soviet Union. And indeed they did. So that the covert operation in Afghanistan in a Cold War context turned out to be a great success. However, in the context of the war for the greater Middle East, it turned out to be a costly blunder. Because even when the Soviets then withdrew at the end of the 1980s, these jihadists that we had been supporting didn't simply put down their arms and go away. We had created the conditions for a civil war in Afghanistan that culminated in the 1990s in the Taliban gaining control of the country, with the Taliban then subsequently providing sanctuary to a guy called Osama bin Laden, and so that he could plot the 9/11 attacks. So our fingerprints are on that, too.
Sarah, thank you for your call. Let's go quickly to Lynn, who is in Eau Claire. Lynn, hello.
Hello, good afternoon, and my sincere condolences to for the loss of your son. I'm wondering how much our 24-hour media cycle has to do with the American perception of what goes on in the Middle East. We're very ill-educated, and when a notorious news service seems to be the one that most people just, you know, they're religious advocates, it doesn't help.
Mm-hmm. Before you respond to Lynn, there was a you quote David Petraeus's Princeton PhD dissertation where the general wrote, "What policymakers believed to have taken place in any particular case is what matters more than what actually occurred." Is that kind of what we're seeing in some of the media coverage here as well?
Well, I think it's true, and I think it would be fair to say that, in particular, the television news business has become more partisan, less objective, more concerned with chasing ratings than with trying to provide a balanced, historically rooted picture. And so I have to agree with Lynn that what we get from the news cycle tends not to be helpful. Of course, there is a remedy. I don't mean to be facetious. The remedy is for us to turn off our televisions and to then spend more time with sources, books, articles that may, in fact, provide a deeper understanding of exactly what's going on and of how we got here. So the information is available. It's just not going to come to you if for anybody who spends 24/7 watching Fox News or MSNBC.
Well, and it is, I mean, it's work for us to do that. When you have to go and do your own homework and dig up the research, that's maybe more work than some people feel they have the time for or are interested in. I want to go back to something that you commented on earlier. We just kind of briefly touched on it, but as we're coming to the end here, we've had a number of emails from people. We didn't read all of them, but talking about presidential candidates and what they've been saying, when you look at the crop of presidential candidates, do you think any of them are really ready to handle the situation should they be elected based on what they've said so far?
Well, I mean, this will end up sounding like a partisan statement. I don't mean it to be, but it strikes me that the two leading candidates on the Republican side, Mr. Trump and Senator Cruz, are equally unqualified, and that for either of those gentlemen to become commander in chief could well produce catastrophic results if they mean what they say on the stump. On the Democratic side, there's no question that Secretary Clinton is seasoned and intelligent. My complaint with Secretary Clinton is that she is too much, I think, a prisoner of the status quo. She is her instincts are hawkish. I see little evidence of a willingness to pose first order questions. That leaves Senator Sanders. Until the other day, he made a speech on foreign policy out in Utah. His candidacy has all but ignored foreign policy issues as he hammers away his themes of economic injustice. But Sanders does seem to me to be somebody who may be a source of fresh thinking. That said, were we to elect Senator Sanders president, we would, once again, be installing somebody as commander in chief who would learn the job while on the job, mm-hmm. And that is, I think, always likely to be an iffy proposition.
All right. Andrew Bacevich, we have to leave it there because we're out of time. Thank you so much for spending this afternoon with us.
Thank you.
Andrew Bacevich is our guest. The show was produced by K.P. Whaley. Chris Molina handled on-air production. And we, of course, always appreciate the help of Dave Potratz. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.